Has the dog humping gotten out of control? No, it's just these crazy postmodern journals that are out of control. Let's take a closer look.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome all to the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today I want to talk about nonsense. Oh, all kinds of nonsense. And in particular, there's this kind of nonsense out in the world that has been called fashionable nonsense. It's the kind of stuff you see in academia, universities, you know, in elite magazines, things like that, that try to sound really profound and meaningful, but it's just a hopeless mishmash of jargon and nonsensical terms that are just lumped together in order to prove usually some kind of progressive or liberal political point. What's interesting here is that the people who are discovering, seeing this and want to expose it for what it is, that this postmodern relativistic thinking that is poisoning academia, poisoning the minds of young people who are going off to college, who are trying to get an education and instead are being indoctrinated into pure absurdity, are a lot of people actually on the other side of issues that I care a lot about. Take, for example, committed atheists. I love there's a term coined by Daniel Dennett, you know, one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. He calls, you know, these kinds of things deepities. You know, a deepity is something that seems like a profound question, but, you know, it really isn't. Or take, for example, the work of these three secular humanists, Helen Pluckrose, James A. Lindsay, and Peter Boghossian. Recently, the Chronicle for Higher Education, they released an article talking about a series of hoax papers that these three professors had submitted to different journals. Right in Chronicle for Higher Ed, it says that the trio spent 10 months writing 20 hoax papers that illustrate and parody what they call grievance studies and submitting them to the best journals in the relevant subfields. And 7 of these 20 hoax papers were published. In another write-up in Slate magazine, it says that among these put-ons, so these kind of crazy studies, these hoax studies that the trio came up with, was a study on the incidence of dog-on-dog sexual assault in Portland, Oregon, one on men's unwillingness to self-penetrate with certain sex toys during masturbation that they said would help to curb transphobia, and an ethnography of men who frequent restaurants like Hooters. According to Harvard lecturer Yaska Monk, he says, you can now be made a professor and get to teach college kids by spewing absurd ideological BS. And so, as I said, these people on the other side, Peter Boghossian actually wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists, and James Lindsay, he wrote a book called ... Why God Doesn't Make Sense. So, and Pluckrose is also in her bio that she's a very fervent secular humanist. She writes about religion's effects on women. But I've noticed this. You've already heard the term strange bedfellows before, and that's not when you wake up in the morning, your dog has jumped into bed or something like that, desiring your attention, you do something like that. One of the 800 reasons I don't have any animals of my own. I have wonderful little children who are more than capable of making their own messes to clean up that usually my saintly wife is the first to clean up at. But back to what I was saying, strange bedfellows, you know, people who are apart from you, on the other side of you when it comes to many different issues, who share a common bond. You say, well, even though we disagree on a lot, hey, we both agree that we've got to be opposed to this. It's kind of like that old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So if atheists who, there are the rare atheists who are committed to objective truth, who reject relativism, reject loony postmodern thinking that denies the idea of truth, then they see in us Christians, hey, you Christians, you also believe in objective truth. We disagree about the nature of that truth and about whether God exists or Jesus rose from the dead, things like that. But hey, we've got something in common. So this is something that if you have a friend who is a committed atheist or an agnostic, that you can say to him, hey, there's one thing you should find helpful among, you know, with Christians, to say that we both believe in truth and we can unite against a culture that firmly rejects truth. Like, we're in a kind of post-truth age, and just any string of words that's put forward with enough emotion and sincerity behind them can carry the day, which is madness. And so what Lindsay Bogosian and Pluckrose were arguing against in their hoax series, what they were trying to do, was combating this tendency in academia to embrace just identity politics, progressive political agendas couched in pseudo-academic terms. And you might think some of this is just silly. Well, aren't they being a little over the top, you know, dog-on-dog rape studies, things like that? They're not, because when you read these academic journals and what is being proposed in the ivory tower, which then goes to professors who teach at universities, which then gets drilled into the minds of sophomores in college who end up acting very sophomoric after they hear this, you can see this is a real problem. I'll point you to that. Here's a real study with real in quotation marks, because it's real in the sense that it's sincere, but it still embraces these terrible postmodern elements of truth and jargon. I'll read it for you to hear. This is from 2016. This study, it's called Glaciers, Gender, and Science: A Feminist Glaciology Framework for Global Environmental Climate Change. Here is an abstract from that study. An excerpt from this study. Feminist and post-colonial theories enrich and complement each other by showing how gender and colonialism are co-constituted, as well as how both women and indigenous peoples have been marginalized historically. Feminist glaciology builds from feminist post-colonial science studies, analyzing not only gender dynamics and situated knowledges, but also alternative knowledges and folk glaciologies that are generally marginalized through colonialism, imperialism, inequality, unequal power relations, patriarchy, and the domination of Western science. I loved in Reason Magazine a comment on this. The author said, "Remember, this is a paper about how to feminize a giant hunk of ice." but you see this idea that people will take elements from the sciences, from mathematics, cobble it together just to put forward this different kind of nonsense and pass it off as science. So I'm going to play for you now. This is a short clip from thestranger.com with an article about Lindsay Bogosian and Pluckrose and what they were doing. Here's what they said in the video describing their work.
Since approximately June of 2017, I, along with two other concerned academics, Peter Bogosian and Helen Pluckrose, have been writing intentionally broken academic papers and submitting them to highly respected journals in fields that study gender, race, sexuality, and similar topics. We did this to expose a political corruption that's taken hold of the university. By this point, several of these papers have been accepted in highly respected journals, and one that claims that dog humping incidents can be taken as evidence of rape culture has been officially honored as excellent scholarship. I'm not going to lie to you. We had a lot of fun with this project.
The reviewers are worried that we didn't respect the dog's privacy.
That's the concern.
We respected the journal.
But don't let that lead you to believe that we're not addressing a serious problem. If you have a few minutes, I'll try to explain.
So here's the problem that they're getting at. When you're on university campuses, for example, you'll have people who will put forward ideas about rape culture, that we live in a culture that tolerates or even promotes rape, white privilege, colonialism, patriarchy, all these terms are bandied about. And then they're supported by this pseudo-scholarly, pseudo-scientific journal articles. And it's ammunition that's given to students who act as kind of the activists. So in the video, when he's talking about, I think that was Lindsay who was talking about the problems here, it showed images of students angrily confronting their teachers and their professors, yelling at them, getting in their faces, saying, "This is our safe space. You're making us unsafe. You're marginalizing us." And so it turns what should be a pursuit of a sober, disciplined, rigorous pursuit of knowledge in the university. That one of the ways you get there is through healthy debate and the exchange of ideas. That modern universities now have turned that into a safe space where you are told what to believe. And if you disagree, you're committing microaggressions or crimes against other people, and you should be penalized for doing that. And if you don't go along with the program, you're a bad actor. You're an agent of the patriarchy, or you know, whatever it might be. So here's another excerpt from Iroh where the trio published this story. And this is what they said. They said, "This is the primary point of the project. What we just described, which is what happens in their fields." And what they tried to do is they looked at things that are, they said were depraved or unethical or absurd, and how it's justified. He said, what we just described in these papers is not knowledge production. It's sophistry. That is, it's a forgery of knowledge that should not be mistaken for the real thing. The biggest difference between us and the scholarship we are studying by emulation is that we know we made things up. Now, there is an interesting objection. I've read also the opposing pieces to this, and people are saying this is, you know, what are you doing? You're wasting people's time. Peer reviewers operate in good faith. You shouldn't be purposely doing these sort of hoax papers or wasting people's time with this sort of deception. And Yaska Mount, the Harvard lecturer I referenced earlier, he said, well, wait a minute. How do we know so much about hiring discrimination? Why, for example, do we know so much about hiring discrimination against women and ethnic minorities? Because researchers send out fake curriculum vitaes or resumes and see how real employers respond. Do we seriously want to stop these studies? That would be lunacy in my mind. So in sociology studies and different kinds of studies, you'll send out deceptive things to see if they can make it through the gatekeepers, to see if the procedures are working. And this works all the time. I mean, they did that test a while back of Transportation Security Administration, TSA, to see, you know, if they could catch, you know, can you catch the terrorists going through the security detectors with weapons? And like 98% of the time, they couldn't do it. So in these academic peer-reviewed journals, the peer reviewers are supposed to be the gatekeepers that keep out the nonsensical and bad ideas. And they've just failed at that because there's no objective standard for what is a bad idea or something that's not worth publishing, at least in these literary journals, postmodern journals. Because, you know, if you submit these things to Nature, to Cell Biology, to hard science journals, if it's just nonsense, it doesn't pass. You got to have data and a real argument here. But this tradition of pointing out how many academic scholars in the liberal arts who embrace this kind of post-truth mindset, where they fall apart, this actually goes back to 1996, to a very famous hoax that you should know about in the history of science and liberal arts education, things like that. It's called the Sokal hoax. Alan Sokal was a physics professor, and he was tired of these left-wing academics, literary theorists, postmodern critics taking science and just completely butchering it to support their insane ideologies. So he decided, he was the first person to do this, at least famously do it, to submit a joke paper to, I think it was to Social Text, was the journal. And this is the original paper. It was called Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. So Sokal purposely wrote a paper to submit to this literary journal, this postmodern journal, using physics jargon that made He was purposely doing that, that it made absolutely no sense. Here is an excerpt. Here's what he writes in this fake article he submitted to Social Text. "Just as liberal feminists are frequently content with a minimal agenda of legal and social equality for women and pro-choice, so liberal and even some socialist mathematicians are often content to work within the hegemonic Zermelo-Frankel framework, which, reflecting its 19th century liberal origins, already incorporates the axiom of equality, supplemented only by the axiom of choice. This paragraph has no meaning. It is a complete mishmash. It takes liberal ideology about feminism and rights to abortion or pro-choice, and then mixes it with Zermelo-Frankel set theory. And the axiom of choice, which is just the axiom of choice has nothing to do with reproductive choice or pro-choice or choosing anything. It just deals with preventing paradoxes in set theory, which is an entirely other fascinating realm that we could get into in mathematics. But he did this and wrote it, and it was actually selected to appear in a special like commemorative issue of Social Text, you know, in this groundbreaking defense of this particular literary theory. And it's so ridiculous. So this is what Sokal actually says later about the hoax. He said, "The results of my little experiment demonstrate, at the very least, that some fashionable sectors of the American academic left have been getting intellectually lazy. The editors of Social Text liked my article because they liked its conclusion that, quote, the content and methodology of postmodern science provide powerful intellectual support for the progressive political project. They apparently felt no need to analyze the quality of the evidence, the cogency of the arguments, or even the relevance of the arguments to the purported conclusion." So what can we take away from all of this? Number one, I think we need to point out to people what happens when you embrace a relativistic theory of truth, when you just believe truth is simply what I feel or what you think, and that each person has their own truth. I know I promised last week I was going to do a special bonus feature for the subscribers, my thoughts on the Kavanaugh hearing. I am going to post that later today or tomorrow. I actually wanted to wait to see what would happen on Saturday when everything was up in the air during the hearings. But I remember Senator Cory Booker was telling Dr. Christine Blasey Ford during her testimony, and he was saying it to Brett Kavanaugh, she shared her truth. You know, she shared her truth, and we want to hear your truth. I hate that phrase. You should share, speak your truth. It was speak your truth. Go ahead, speak your truth. There is no such thing as your truth or my truth. Now, there are subjective truths. You know, there are some things that are true only for me, like, you know, for me and other people, like I like mint chocolate chip ice cream. That's true for me and not necessarily for you. But there just is truth. Now, there is your idea of the truth, your truth claim, your belief as to what the truth is. But there's no such thing as just your truth and my truth when it comes to objective truths about things that happen in reality. There's our opinions, beliefs, or conceptions of the truth, but the truth itself remains objective. Another thought that just occurs to me here when dealing with relativization of the truth, this kind of postmodern literary theory, I also absolutely hate its artistic form. When Laura and I were on our honeymoon in Europe several years ago, back in 2013, we went through Paris, you know, Paris, oh, the city of lights, oh yes, Paris, so romantic. Two interesting things. One, we got dinner reservations at 7. I found out that in Paris, you know, that's like getting a dinner reservation here in the U.S. at 3 p.m. Nobody eats that early. We were in the restaurant all by ourselves. Two, we went to all of the different sites, museums. So we went to the Louvre, the Orsay. So that's art all the way up to the 19th century. And then we went to the Pompidou, Le Pompidou. And the Pompidou is where they have all the 20th century art. And it is bad. It is so bad. I walked through there and there was just a tire in the middle of a room and it like said, you know, some goofy title, you know, supposed to be a big art piece. And I'm like, this is a tire. It was like a tire with like a piece of wood through it. Another was a blank white canvas, or there was a white and a black canvas next to each other. And it was like duality. And Laura just said, I hate the Pompidou. Can we please leave? Now, I appreciated some of the art was interesting, cuckoo, and I do have a appreciation for the surreal and the bizarre. But the idea here that suddenly you reach the 20th century, that prior to that, there are standards. You can tell when someone's made good or bad art. Now, since you can't impose your truth on anyone else, you get things like abstract art that look like it could have been, you know, created by a toddler, an elephant, a bunch of monkeys. And we're supposed to take it seriously as art simply because of what the artist believes, not because of what it objectively is. Number two, I think something else to take away that even in our own lives, we should be careful when we believe in a cause, not just to take any data, any argument, any article we read to back it up. Because that's what's happening here in these academic journals. If you have anything, I mean, the trio, Boghossian, Lindsay, and Pluckrose, you know, the article they wrote on dog-on-dog rape culture, you know, it's embraced because people want it to be true. You know, they want to prove there's rape culture deep-seated in our institutions, and if this dog-on-dog park study can prove it, well, let's push it through. And we do the same thing all the time. We'll believe something, and you'll share an article on Facebook or on Twitter, and like, oh, this proves what I'm saying. Be careful, because it might not actually do that. You need to be able to read through that to be able to determine it. And I'm even aware that this study has limits itself. And as I said, I read the opposition limits to it. And people said, well, they falsified data. And the dog-on-dog study could have been interesting if there were real data related to it. But at the same time, I feel like what's going on here is it's not so much about those data elements, the data elements. It's about trying to push an overall philosophical or ethical theory using very sketchy observations to be able to relate that. So as I said, when you're looking at things, don't make the same error these liberal academics make of just taking in anything you read. And if you do take in something that turned out to be incorrect, you know, just own up for it. Say, I'm not human. Sorry, I guess I made a mistake here. I'll reevaluate what I believe. And, you know, if I shared this article and it turned out to be false, I mean, it happens to me from time to time, and that's something I'm willing to do. And last but not least, I think we should really encourage academics, or just anyone in general, become a better writer. I think a lot of times in these journals, you'll see jargon and terrible writing to support conclusions. And it's because a lot of people just aren't taught to be good writers. And I feel bad that young people go to college, they go to liberal arts schools, not the really good ones out there. There's some very good Catholic ones you can check out. But others that don't pride themselves on truth, they just pride themselves on rhetoric. On just crafting any great sounding piece of prose that's technical or almost obtuse, that if it were simple sounding, people might think that you're a simpleton. And that's a great mistake people make when they write. A lot of amateur writers, when they start out, they'll purposely write convoluted, long, run-on sentences because they think they have to sound smart. I don't want you to sound smart. I want you to be smart. Just write simple sentences, subject, verb, object, repeat, rinse and repeat. That gets to the point of what you're making. Steven Pinker actually wrote an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education a few years back about this problem in academia. I love how he starts out his article. He says, together with wearing earth tones, driving Priuses, and having a foreign policy, the most conspicuous trait of the American professoriate may be the prose style called academies. An editorial cartoon by Tom Tolles shows a bearded academic at his desk offering the following explanation of why SAT verbal scores are at an all-time low. Quote, incomplete implementation of strategized programmatics designated to maximize acquisition of awareness and utilization of communication skills pursuant to standardized review and assessment of languagenal development. It's funny, like Pinker goes on to say, you know, he was reading in some people say, well, it's just jargon because when you're in a specialized field, you have to use jargon. And Pinker says, no, that's not it, because in his own field of psychology, he reads horrible things like this. Participants read assertions whose veracity was either affirmed or denied by the subsequent presentation of an assessment word. Pinker writes, after some detective work, I determined that the author meant participants read sentences, each followed by the word true or false. So the original academies, he says, was not as concise, accurate, or scientific as the plain English translation. So why did my colleague feel compelled to pile up the polysyllables? The answer, and I'm glad that Pinker caught on to this, he talked about how there's a writing style in academia that is self-conscious, relativistic, ironic, or postmodern. Its concern is to escape being convicted of philosophical naivety about your own enterprise. So the idea is here, you're exposed to all of these different beliefs, and if you don't write in this kind of convoluted, obtuse way, if you sound sure or certain, well, then you're like one of those fundamentalist Christians who thinks, I definitely know I'm right and everybody else is wrong, that if you write in a simple way and you're sure about something, then you're just, you know, you're dogmatic. You ever hear that? People say, oh, don't be dogmatic. Well, there's nothing wrong with being dogmatic if something is 100% infallibly true. You know, like I'm dogmatically opposed to child molestation. I think it's wrong and dogmatically so. And most people will agree that it's weird. People are so scared of certainty. Certainty is like a religious thing. But we have to have certainty in some fields in our every day-to-day work. Even religious people, like within our own Catholic faith, there's a taxonomy. There's dogmatically revealed truths, infallibly defined. There are truths that are proposed for us to believe, but can be modified or provided greater clarity. They're not infallibly defined. The church even allows for people to have theological speculation about things that may or may not be a part of the faith, like the existence of limbo, for example, you know, the question of where do unbaptized babies go? Theologians were allowed to speculate about that. The church just didn't give you a dogmatic set of rules and say, you follow this, that's the end of it. Theology is something that's allowed to grow and develop as we understand the deposit of faith more over time. So I hope that was helpful for you all listening through. I'm glad to be back here in the saddle again this week to give you more insights into our culture, our church, and theology, apologetics, anything you'd like to hear. And of course, on Fridays, where you get all kinds of free-for-all Friday from me. Hope you keep listening to the podcast and share it with others. I am going to post my thoughts on the Kavanaugh hearing and another bonus, some other bonus interviews with people later this week that I think you'll enjoy. If you'd like access to that content and more, and to keep the podcast going, to reach people, I hope you will visit TrentHornPodcast.com, where you can become a subscriber, get access to extra content, and keep us on the internet and hopefully expanded to radio and to other parts here to Into the Unknown. Thanks for listening, and I hope you all have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.